Accession number 19922, reel 6.
Barry Smith, reel 6.
Yes, so as I say, if it wasn't for the fact that being well trained, because when you were out on these operations, line laying, where you were requested to go on patrols, although you were with colleagues, you felt quite alone, quite vulnerable. It was just you were well trained in that you knew that if you carried out the job that you were taught to do in a certain way, that there's a very good chance that you complete it and get back safely on whatever thing you were involved in.
Can you tell, you were about to tell me, I think, about what happened to you on this hill, John, 227?
Well, on another occasion, we were, from time to time, we were drawn out of the line for a rest. I was, they used to go to take you out the line, then you, for example, to have a wash, because, now I'm going to digress now, there's a lot more I've suddenly remembered. We would come out, we would be taken out of line in about threes or fours or sixes, something like that, and taken back to the reserve. You'd eventually march back and then get on the lorries, and these lorries were all, especially in the summer, would trundle down these dusty roads to the reserve. I think it was Camp Casey and one or two other places, which are a bit vague now. And your clothes would be stripped off you. You'd have these communal showers and what have you, and you couldn't tell officers from men in the shower, obviously. But very rudimentary, and you'd be given fresh clothes and what have you. Then you return to your positions up in the line, having been able to have a wash, because in the line, we were only allowed to have so much water and drinking water. We couldn't drink anything out of the streams, not that there was anywhere we were, but it was all water specially treated and brought up by the gooks, who were the Chinese Korean labourers that would hump the water up the hills for us in big petrol cans, rather like Jeep petrol cans, but they're full of water. And these are all manhandled up the hills. We are rationed to so much water a day. We obviously would, if you did do any cooking, it was on these oil stoves that were made out of old ammunition boxes with a drip feed. During the winter, which could get down to 40 below, in the cruel winds that came down from the north, Siberia, what have you, Mongolia, so I believe that's where they come down from. The wind chill factor was the most dangerous thing. We would keep warm in the bunkers, especially the main bunker where the officers were. We'd have the a chuffer, which is nothing more or less than a earth field, half filled with earth, ammunition box with a drip feed from an oil tank up on the roof behind the bunker, and this would be flattened, this tube flattened in such a way that it would drip at a regular rate and onto the soil, and this was then lit, and this is the way we used to keep warm. We ate very little fresh food. Very little. In fact, the fact that I have hardly any of my own teeth is due to that, because when I came out of the British Army, most of my teeth were either infected or had to be removed. My wife tells me that if I'd had better dentists in those days, a good part of my teeth could have been saved. But I've been living on tin food, C7s, American rations, good though they were, obviously full of preservatives, and this didn't do your teeth any good. So one thing that suffered from there was my teeth. I've got all false teeth now, and I'm not grumbling about that, but my teeth deteriorated at an alarming rate on coming out of the army. We had very little fresh food in that sense. Occasionally we got Canadian hams and tins of cheeses and what have you. So if you did get fresh food, you were very lucky. And it wasn't possible to go back to the field kitchens and have better cooked field food unless, of course, you were on the line of hills where they have these facilities. Back at base camp they had them. Anyway, to go back to being taken back to have a wash and brush up, as it were, we couldn't wash in the line, not very well anyhow. A ration of water, you could just try and keep you basically clean. In the winter, we had a command from our Sergeant Major, which is quite unusual in the British Army, is that we, if we wanted to, we didn't have to shave, because the cold was such, if you had fair skin like myself, for example, that if you shave with a cutthroat, very quickly get infections of your skin, which was caused by the extreme cold and harsh conditions, and also the driving winds. So therefore, I've got pictures of myself in combat equipment sporting quite a bit of growth. This was allowed by the Sergeant Major because of the conditions. He didn't want anyone going down through the conditions of ill health in the line. You all expected, really, as I said, to part of our training, to look after yourselves. The officers in charge of you, you meet when you work as a signaller, you're immediately under their command working with them, and then envied position possibly by some other fusiliers who thought you were on a nice little number, which is far from the truth, because as I said previously, you were constantly at work, and the officers, if an officer went on a patrol and he wanted a signaller, he would say, "Signaller, with me," and you'd go. Wherever you went, where the officer went, you went. And as you know, the officer could go right into the thick of it. If you were, I'm digressing again, when we were trained initially, we were told, although it didn't sink in until I got to Korea, we were told that if you're in a wartime situation, the enemy would, this is what Sergeant Sheridan told us in no uncertain times, we were about to become signallers, he'd say, "Well, I want you to ponder with these few thoughts before you decide to become signallers. In that if you become a signaller, you'll be with the officers. You're expected to know your job, and woe betide you if you don't know it. You have to be right on the ball. They expect you to know it just like that. If you get into a wartime situation, operation, the first person that they're going to try and take out, an enemy party to take out, will be the officer and the signaller. It's a sobering thought." He said, "Do you wish to become signallers from now on?" Anyway, you wanted to become signallers, that's not here nor there. It was a leg up in the army. I became a corporal. And also you got extra money for being a tradesman. Some became machine gunners or drivers, and they got an extra grade. So although the money wasn't a lot in those days, it was a step in the right direction. And right, I was talking about training, and I do feel that it is my training that certainly gave me longevity. Some other fusiliers or some other critics might say this is a bit of exaggeration, but I think in my case it certainly helped me no end. We were talking about going back and having showers and then to clean up. By the time we got back to just behind the lines on these lorries in the summer, we went filthy. And when we came back, we were just as filthy because the dust of the roads would coat us in dust. Yeah, there were goggles on the back of the lorries because the dust of the summer was so great. In fact, the lorries that were carrying ammunition or lorry convoys in those days behind the lines, these could be picked up by the Chinese if the dust created by lorries in the summer, I'm talking about summer months now, ammunition lorries and what have you would be have to follow each other with quite a bit of distance between each one, because if they were strafed by the enemy, obviously be hit with if one was hit, the other ones would get through, what have you. This is a safety precaution, but wherever you went, the lorries wouldn't hang about. They weren't going to crawl along creating dust and then attract a bit of fire, they're going to get through as quick as possible. This is my my feelings on the matter. Anyway, we arrived back in the line no better than we went. The sweat through doing the job in the summer and in those conditions, wearing layers of clothing, what have you, especially the amount of layers of clothing we had to use during the winter, used to create skin infections. I had ringworm on my arms very badly. I won't go into what ringworm is, but it's just a skin caused by a bug which is caused through not being able to wash properly. When we got back, when we were coming out of Korea before dispatch on the troop ships, we had every bit of our skin inspected by doctors, and DDT was sprayed down our uniforms and what have you. We were then told, and I was told, along with others, that coming back on the boat, we would have to take as many saltwater baths, showers on the troop ship as possible to clear our skin. Many of us were considered too unfit to return to England in that they had skin complaints, and these were tried to improve these before they were to come back on the boat, where they're always to be clustered together. These skin complaints could, I suppose, be passed on, but the medical officers wouldn't allow you to travel unless they deemed you fit to do so. Eventually the eye ringworm disappeared. I've still got the scars on my arm today, although they're very faint. Such was the conditions. Talking about conditions out there, I can remember them lighting fires underneath the jeeps just to warm up the bottom of the vehicle so they could get them started, because oil would freeze almost solid in those conditions. They're very sluggish. That is diesel, especially. The oil's in the sumps of the jeep, I should say. I can remember boiling water and it freezing almost immediately. So in the winter, working out on patrol or on operations, as I've previously explained, we wore many layers of clothing. In fact, I had my own vest, then a string vest, then an army shirt, and an army heavy pullover, followed by an anorak, followed by a heavy parka, which could be which is the sort of thing they wear in the Arctic, army issue. We had rubber sole boots. These were quite novel because we've been trained in the original army hobnail boots, because hobnail boots at night on patrol can cause sparks on the, as it was, a rough countryside then. It's now green, they tell me. But and these sparks, as minute as they are, could be seen quite a way at a distance. We had no caps or cap badges were disallowed. All brass work was disallowed. Brass equipment, we had all gunmetal equipment. And in fact, I had some photographs which... have gone missing, but I've got some of them upstairs here, that show me looking more like an American soldier than English, yeah, than a traditional British soldier. Our equipment then was gradually getting in line with the modern American equipment. We had to wear steel helmets because there was a lot of... we used to wear cap comforters at one time, woolly hats and what have you, and peak, little American-type peak caps, but we were told that not to discard these and wear steel helmets at all times. This was an order was issued not long after we got into the line, because many casualties were experienced through head injuries through mortar shell blasts, as mortars, you know, travels outwards. And a helmet gives you better protection. So with walking around with all this equipment, it's quite cumbersome. You'd have Arctic socks, string vests, and, as I've explained, and gloves. If in the cold you were out in the field and in the early hours of the morning, you could put your fingers on a barrel of a machine gun, and it could almost stick there because of the cold, the extreme cold that would form on metal. So the conditions we were working in were quite hazardous, to say the least. At night time, I know this as a signaler, you get privy to all this information. In any case, it turns the rubber on you, off on you, even if you're not involved in it at that particular moment. In that the forward trenches of a position, the listening trenches, what have you, in extreme cold, the sergeant major would go round at night and visit each position to make sure that none of the soldiers who, as I say, we got tired, would drop off to sleep in that sense. Because if they did, it is experienced in the American Army, it's all written down about this, where sentries had been posted and they'd gone back to them several hours later or at a later date, and they'd been frozen to death because they dozed off and the cold had overcome them because of fatigue or what have you. So this is a thing that sergeant majors or they had to watch. You had to stay awake. Quite a lot of smoking was done, and said to stay awake if you're in a trench which is up on an exposed position. And the only way you could smoke to stay awake was to put a cigarette in the middle of your palm. But if you lit a fire to cook any food, we had these small stoves made of these little tablets we used to just light. If you lit these and it was at night, this glow in a trench could be seen for quite a distance. So it was quite a hazardous operation, one way or another, trying to just feed yourself. Most of, as I say, if you wanted to eat, you could eat during the day where it wouldn't show up in that sense. When we were in reserve, every so often we were taken back. One particular occasion, we were taken back out of the line and in reserve. Now, a reserve company... I don't know how many men it was that consisted of that time. You would be obviously they'd all get you'd service equipment and you'd have food, kitchen cooked food that I explained to you earlier on that we couldn't have up in the line, and you would still be an operation company as you were in the line. But if there was a sudden emergency in the line, you would be called up from your reserve position into the line again. A fighting company on standby, as you might say. On one occasion, I was just signalling this, we were called in the early hours, very early hours in the morning, to go up to a hill called 355. It was in this area, and I believe it was the Canadians. They had what they'd done is they'd gone back to a mill behind the hill, they, some of them had left their rifles and automatics behind. Some of them had taken their boots off to ease their feet, as it were, have a rest up. And whilst all this was happening, a Korean company, or a large band of Chinese, not Korean, had been laying up on the wire, and in the early hours of the morning, they merely came straight over the top, virtually overrunning the hill. The Canadians, I'm sure it was the Canadians, because we were called up, and I remember I think the Sergeant Major then, he's now a Colonel, he was then a Sergeant called Pettifer, or Sergeant Major Pettifer. When we got up to the Canadian positions, I remember two large searchlights shining on the opposite hill, and you could make out the flashes of the Chinese firing and pursuing party of, I don't know, it must have been Canadians, chasing them back out, fighting them back, as it were, to their own positions, clearing our lines. On the top of the hill, there was two large recoilless rifles firing at point blank to the opposite hill. It was, in fact, or you might say, all hell let loose. Absolute mayhem. We'd been called in to stabilise the position. And my Pettifer, I'm sure it's Pettifer, said to me, I come to think sometimes when this is 355, also we had a situation like this on the well-known sector called the Hook. Very exposed forward positions within the forward trenches are exposed to the Chinese view, as it were. And when we approached this hill, he said to me as the signaller, get in there and restore communications, because everything had gone haywire. This is, as I say, the position that I personally was put into, where you expected to know your job just like that, and you would then crash in on the net, establish and consolidate the actual communications, so then they could proceed from then to stabilise the situation. That was my responsibility in that. Also, we had to stand guard when we weren't operating the sets, myself and my colleague. I mean, this is all expected of you. We're after all basically an infantry soldier, not just a signaller. You would be called on to go on raiding parties as a fighting infantryman, and you'd be no different than any other infantryman. You had been trained the same way, only obviously you were a little bit more specialised in that you were a qualified signaller, company signaller. Your situation and the feelings you had when you suddenly pitched into the situation is hard to describe. It's, as I say, it's all around you is mayhem. You have no control on of what's going on. Although you're the signaller establishing communications, and you've got to just do your job to your utmost, what's going on around you is out of your control, and you're merely taken along, swallowed up, as it were, and taken along in a tide of events. And the loneliness you feel, or vulnerability you feel, is that it seems to be out of your control, and how the hell is it all going to finish? So when you come through these situations, being so close to what could be a thing that could be very serious for you personally, the fact that you get through these things, and in fact I'm talking for all my colleagues when I say this, and you get and you look back on it in years to come, you think how lucky I was that I wouldn't say I was. I am religious, but I'm not practicing Christian. But I've got great faith, and I think you have to have great faith that you'll come through it. In these situations, you have to have faith in what you've been taught, and in you have to have this faith. Otherwise, the whole thing just falls apart. You're not able to do your job. You're not able to acquit yourself at the best, and you will become a passenger in these situations. They get a situation where all things like this is. It becomes rather like every man for himself, although it's not the case because the officer's in control. But it's a strange feeling, which is not. It's very hard to describe to a person that hasn't been involved in such a situation. Can I end here for a minute? I think at this juncture, I would go out on fighting patrols and be involved in actions when they required signallers, and you'd go out just the same as you would do if you were an ordinary infantryman. But I think don't exaggerate my particular part in all this, as I was one of many. Only to just illustrate what a signaller, at least in my case, would be to contend with. I was in fact a public schoolboy, ex-public schoolboy, and wanted to go into the RAF, but then found I couldn't pass the exams. I eventually got my call-up papers. But part of my training at the public school was that you were given great faith, and this helped you, in fact, to have the courage to go and do things. I don't think talk about people being brave or courageous is difficult to define, but I think you've got to have a certain amount of faith that you'll get through it.
How did the school give you faith?
Pardon?
How did the school give you faith?
Well, you know, with public schools, they teach you how to look after yourself, to be, to have faith and that sort of thing. Have some sort of courage about doing things in life.
Self-reliant, you mean?
That's it. Along those lines, yes, that's it. And signaller was expected to do that, to be that. Because after all, there was no sergeant major, although they were there. And officers, obviously, are always on your back, as it were, or you work with them. They weren't there to come along and pat your back and say, well, come along now, I'll help you with this. You just went out and did the job. And as I say, because you had training and faith, and that gave you the courage to acquit yourself well in these situations. Of course, I shouldn't go any further without telling you about the conditions. In the trenches, when we got there in the summer, there was loads of rats, all different colours. And at night time, if you were laying in bed, you could feel it. I've had them running up and down the bed before now. Horrible feeling. And you couldn't shoot them, as some people wanted to do, with a let off a round, because if someone was to fire a round off, it would immediately alert the enemy, and they would say, right, they're firing, we'll let some off. So we didn't fire unless we were ordered to do so. Only where you were using it, if you were confronted by the enemy, obviously you not only to protect yourself, but you would be forced into that situation. Unless you were given a mandate to attack a position, that's vastly different.